You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When one thinks of how China is working to reassert its dominion over territories it views as part of China, one naturally thinks of Taiwan. But there's another territory that now has largely been possessed, and that's Hong Kong. China's statements of one country, two systems, the idea that Hong Kong would have economic and political autonomy for 50 years after the handover from Britain in 1999, has been largely exposed. For over 20 years, Louisa Lim has reported on Hong Kong and China for the BBC and NPR. And for many years beyond that, she lived in Hong Kong. But in her new book, Indelible City, she explores the hidden history of the city and tries to learn the nature of being a Hong Konger, living in a place where two powers have routinely discounted and ignored your rights as citizens. She also investigates the spirit of a resistance that is exemplified by the most unlikely of sources, the self-proclaimed King of Kowloon, an eccentric garbage collector who believed his family were the rightful heirs of Kowloon and the New Territories, two of the three areas of Hong Kong. His guerrilla street art pronouncing his claim littered the city for close to 50 years and became an odd talisman for the democratic resistance that permeates Lim's book, Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. It's published by Riverhead. Louisa Lim was a correspondent for the BBC and NPR. She's currently a senior lecturer at the University of Melbourne in Australia and hosts the Little Red podcast on China. And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Louisa Lim, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich. It's such a pleasure.
There was so much I learned in this book, from the competing histories of Hong Kong itself to the negotiations that started and ended British rule, to little things like the importance of calligraphy in the culture and the innovative ways Hong Kongers have protested repression. And what did you want readers to know about this city that's been such a large part of your professional life as well as your personal life? You've lived there for many years.
Oh, there's so much that I wanted readers to know about the city. In many ways, this was an exploration of my own into my own city. And when I started, I was just sort of quite astonished at how little I knew about this place that I view as home. Its own history was really so obscured to me, even though I went to school there for so many years, we never learned anything about our own history. And it was only when I started researching it for this book that I realized just how big that kind of gap was. So I guess, you know, there are many things I want people to know about Hong Kong, but one of the most important is really the kind of nature of Hong Kongers, that real sense of mission and the real desire to fight for democracy. When people began standing trial for actions related to various protest movements, I just remember one of my interviewees saying to me, you know, if my crime is to have been politically naive, then so be it. But, you know, these are people who were told that nothing would change for 50 years. They were told that there would be motion towards democracy. They were promised democracy, and they're just trying to hold their rulers to what was promised to them.
Yeah, in fact, Chinese officials said at the switchover ceremony, they said basically Hong Kong will be ruled by Hong Kongers. And that has not necessarily been the case.
It's a tricky thing. I mean, in some ways it has. The people that have ruled Hong Kong, some of them have been viewed as Hong Kongers, but, you know, the question is where the power lies and who gives these people the power to rule. And the problem is that Hong Kongers never got to choose their own leaders. They've always been people who have been foisted upon them by the authorities. And now we're in a situation where Hong Kong is about to have a new chief executive. And there's only one person running for the post. I mean, he's not running for it. There's nobody else, but the person who will get the post, barring anything unforeseen, is the former Secretary for Security, who really oversaw the crackdown on the protest movement. So, you know, there's been this real desire for democracy and for democratic participation. And people have been willing to go out to protest, to put their lives on the line for these ideals. So the way in which the crackdown has happened in Hong Kong, watching it's been so alarming, and seeing sort of this massive exodus out of Hong Kong as well.
Yeah. One thing I was struck by as you were discussing the history around the joint declaration, which was the negotiations where the UK agreed to return Hong Kong to Chinese control. You said, I forget who, it might have been one of your interviewees, or it may have been you, that wrote that throughout Hong Kong's history, there's been one voice that's never been heard in the discussions of the area's future or present, and that's the people of Hong Kong themselves. It seems really interesting that these voices have basically been discounted, whether it was through colonial rule or, again, rule by China.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, when the joint declaration was negotiated, the agreement to hand Hong Kong back to China, Hong Kongers were not allowed to be part of the negotiations. They were not permitted to be present. They had no seat at the table. There was no vote, no referendum, no sort of mechanism by which they could approve or not approve it. So the decision was just made over their heads. And, you know, one of the real drivers for me was to try and center Hong Kong voices in telling Hong Kong's story. I went to see a historian whose name is Tim Kung, and I was asking him about the sort of colonial history books, and he just looked at me and he said there were no names, no faces for Chinese. And I went back and I was reading my history books, and I realized that he was completely right. It was this sort of laundry list of British governors, and Hong Kong people were almost never mentioned. So I wanted to upend that.
And in the course of learning about Hong Kong's past, it's not an easy proposition. It all depends on who's writing the history. Can you tell us about these competing histories?
Yes, absolutely. So there's really two separate narratives, and, you know, depending on which sovereign power has controlled Hong Kong. So the British narrative, really the story that was told when I was a child, was that, you know, Hong Kong was a barren rock before British arrival in the 1840s. You know, there was almost nothing there. And it's because of the British control of Hong Kong that it became this sort of great emporium of trade. Whilst the Chinese story is really very different. The Chinese story is that Hong Kong has been part of China since time immemorial, and that it has always been a part of China. And then, you know, when I started looking, there's this story in between, which is a really different story, though, which is that, you know, Hong Kong has been part of China, but it has played a very specific function. So, you know, way back in around the 5th century, Hong Kong was a place of refuge for people who had risen up to rebel against central power and had been defeated, and they'd fled to Hong Kong. And so it had become this kind of place for rebels against central authority. And over the years, we've seen, even in the 11th, 12th century, there were all these rebellions against central authority, against the salt monopoly. People were killed. You know, there's a whole other kind of hidden history. And that's what I was interested in.
Yeah, it reads as though it was sort of only loosely controlled by the central government of China. And it was, you know, different language, probably different customs as well. And it was sort of like, we tolerate it until it gets intolerable, and then we go subdue it again. It seemed like that sort of history when it comes
That's right. I mean, there's been this phrase in Chinese, which is often used to describe the sort of imperial rule over the dynasties, which is, you know, the heavens are high and the emperor is far away. And that was very much the case for Hong Kong.
Well, you begin the book Indelible City with just before China's National Day in 2019, and you're on a rooftop of a skyscraper in Hong Kong, and you're among people in the protest movement. That National Day protest was a very large protest against the situation and the repression in Hong Kong, and you're with them as they're making large posters, and this was sort of a critical day for you because as a journalist, you're an observer, you're not a participant. And on that day, you, at least in a small way, participated. Why was it important to start the book with this story?
I think it was important for me to start the book with that story because it really kind of placed me in so many ways. You know, when I was writing the book, I did feel a really conflict between being a Hong Konger and being a journalist. And, you know, I didn't really want to have to choose. I wanted to be able to be both a Hong Konger and a journalist. And this idea that you can, as a journalist, sort of magically remove yourself from the situation that you're sort of floating above, in many ways, this didn't allow us, I think, to tell Hong Kong's story properly, that distance, that to really tell it, you almost have to be part of it. And that day I did take that step. So they were painting these gigantic protest banners that are hung from the territory's mountaintops. And it's this group of sign painters that are really a secret collective that I'd always heard about, but I didn't know who they were. And they got in touch with me. They had heard. So I, over the years in writing the book, I've been quite obsessed with this very particular Hong Kong icon. And I was also sort of, you know, this book in many ways, it was my story. It was the story of Hong Kong, but it was also the story of this icon who's the King of Kowloon is what he was known as. And he became this kind of cultural hero in many ways for Hong Kongers. And he was this old disabled trash collector with mental health problems who believed that the peninsula of Kowloon, which is opposite Hong Kong, had been stolen from his family when it was ceded to the British in perpetuity. And he spent half a century writing all over the territory on its walls. He was painting his claim to the land, and he became, you know, this iconic figure who is celebrated in song and other artists. And, you know, he was filming TV ads. He was playing cameos in the film, in the territory's films. And he became this sort of really famous figure. And I'd always been obsessed by him. And then when I had this chance to go and interview the sign painters, I just kind of had a moment where I wanted to know what it felt like to really, you know, feel the power of characters, of Chinese characters, of calligraphy. And so I did join in, as you say, in a very small way.
Yeah. That King of Kowloon, this figure is sort of a constant throughout the book. He becomes sort of a guide in a way because it helps understand the way Hong Kongers protest, basically. You know, he was doing this for 50 years, writing characters that said, you know, this land belongs to me, and he's writing it everywhere. It's everywhere. I mean, you know, the sides of buildings, underpasses, any place where there's a fence or anything like that, he's putting this out there. And this has sort of become ingrained in the way Hong Kongers protest.
Yes, and I think that's why he's such a fascinating character for me. I mean, you know, I think his preoccupations, which were really sort of land and sovereignty and dispossession and loss, these are really the central preoccupations for Hong Kongers. And then, you know, his method of protesting also became something that you know, was so central to the movements that we saw later on. And I mean, aside from that, he was also, you know, this figure who has really worked his way into people's hearts. And only last year, Hong Kong opened this new Museum of Visual Culture. It's called M+, and it's this sort of gigantic, beautiful museum, which is meant to be the premier visual arts museum in the whole of Asia. And when you go in, the very first thing that you see is a pair of doors that have been covered with graffiti from the King of Kowloon. And it's, you know, front and center in this new museum because in many ways, he's quite foundational, I think, to Hong Kong's own identity. And when he died, you know, he died in 2007. And when he died, the newspapers, every newspaper had sort of front page coverage saying, the king is dead. So, you know, the king is dead, his people are wailing and crying, the king is dead, his people are mourning him. So in a way, it was quite extraordinary because he actually, you know, I discovered that he didn't actually have a claim on the land. It was probably delusional or imaginary, but in many ways that in the end didn't matter. People almost accepted him as a kind of king, an imaginary king, and they were sort of willing to buy into it, to play along with it.
And what's amazing is, you know, even though he's been dead for now 15 years, occasionally his street art will still pop up as, you know, paint fades. All of a sudden, the characters come back out in some spot somewhere in Hong Kong. It's kind of strange that way.
Well, do you know what's really extraordinary is there's just been a piece that has appeared in the last week, and the government has slightly changed its attitude towards him. And now there looks like there might be an attempt to preserve it, because up till now, the government has not been very keen on his work. You know, a lot of artists did not see him as an artist because, you know, his writing is quite bad in many ways. It's sort of ugly and misshapen, and it isn't beautiful and standardized as Chinese calligraphy is supposed to be. And, you know, that was, I think, one of the things that attracted me to him, the fact that people celebrated his imperfections and he was willing to share them. And anyway, this piece has emerged. And this was another thing that I discovered in the course of my reporting, that one of the people who was very, very close to the King of Kowloon at the end of his life, a man called Joel Chung, he has had this kind of very interesting sort of secret campaign where he's been secretly preserving the king's work. So he knows the sites where the King of Kowloon had once painted, and every year he'll chip away the paint that has been placed on top of it, because often the king's work was covered up by the authorities. He knows where those sites are, so he'll chip away that work, and then he'll cover the king's characters with a clear varnish to preserve it, and then he'll cover it up again. So there's almost like this kind of secret museum of hidden work of his in public space, and I think it's beginning to emerge now.
My guest today is Louisa Lim. She's covered China and Hong Kong for the BBC and the NPR. She's currently a senior lecturer at the University of Melbourne and hosts the Little Red Podcast on China. Her new book is titled Indelible City: Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. It's published by Riverhead, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I was really interested in the section where you write about the negotiations leading up to the joint declaration where the UK returns Hong Kong to Chinese control. You know, having lived through that myself, you know, as I suppose in my naivety, I sensed there was great understanding between British officials and Hong Kongers. And of course, this book exposes that naivety. You know, British officials knew no more about Hong Kong than they knew about India or even America in the 18th century, you know, or most of their possessions they've lost. You know, they never took any time to understand the culture. They simply ruled it as they saw fit. And once the writing was on the wall that China was not going to allow them to renew the concession for the new territories, which is, you know, they were ceded Hong Kong and Kowloon in perpetuity, but you can't control those without the new territories because that's access to water and all the things you need to be able to run the cities. They basically just lost interest and said, well, let's get out of this as easily as we can with as little dust on our lapels.
Yes, that's a really pithy summary of pretty much of what transpired. And I mean, I was really lucky to kind of stumble across this trove of documents on a library shelf. There was a political scientist called Steve Tang, who's actually at the in London at the moment at the School of Oriental and African Studies there. And back in the 1980s and 1990s, he'd done a whole series of interviews with some really senior Hong Kong people who had advised the British government. And they had never been able to speak openly because they'd all signed the Official Secrets Act. But these interviews were held for 30 years from the last event described in the interviews and then released. And by the time they were released, many people had forgotten about them. Even actually the library itself, you know, so there were some interviews that they, you know, were unable to find in the beginning. And, you know, then they sort of released them bit by bit. And when I read them, I was just quite amazed because, you know, it was really the first time that we were hearing these voices of these Hong Kongers. And, you know, they had really felt duty bound because they were advisors to the British government. They had felt duty bound by their honor to sort of support what happened and to support the agreement because there was no alternative. But in these sort of very private conversations, they really sort of unleashed all their anguish, their sorrows, their worries, their fears that Britain had not done enough, and their concerns about what might happen. And, you know, the real tragedy is to read them today and to see just quite how accurate they really were.
It's very interesting that when, you know, you talk to officials like Christopher Patton after the fact, I mean, they pretty much realize that they hung out Hong Kong to its fate. You know, it was not a heroic moment for them. But I do want to talk about one Hong Kong resident who you describe as a tragic hero, S.Y. Chung. Tell us about him, because he probably was the one Hong Konger who knew more about the negotiations and what was happening in the handover of Hong Kong than any other, as they were called, unofficials.
That's right. So they were the unofficial members to the Legislative Council and the Executive Council, which is like a cabinet. And he was the senior unofficial. And he was an engineer by trade. He was not born into money. And, you know, he was seen as very incorruptible. And his interviews were really, you know, quite extraordinary because they really offered this window into the kind of dilemma that he was placed in. And, you know, he really went to great lengths to lobby. He wanted more safeguards for Hong Kongers. He wanted to have, you know, maybe some kind of monitoring mechanism to try and ensure that China kept to its word. And, you know, the British really weren't having any of it. They kept arguing that it would make no difference, that, you know, Britain could only play the cards that it possessed. And, you know, he then went to Deng Xiaoping in Beijing, the Chinese leader, and he laid out his concerns to him. And he said, you know, we're just worried that although you say this is going to happen now, maybe China will change. Maybe there'll be another leader who's more leftist than you are. You know, maybe Hong Kong will be ruled from Beijing in future. And he was humiliated. And, you know, when he returned to Hong Kong, all the headlines were sort of all caps saying humiliation. He had death threats against him. And he really felt that he had stuck his neck out for Hong Kong and he had not got anything. And the kind of warnings that he gave the British were really unequivocal. You know, he told them that he believed China could not be trusted. And, you know, when I read it, I saw him as this tragic hero, you know, although, you know, later in life, after Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule, he really switched sides and he became an advisor to the Chinese. But I really believe that that decision was probably very much informed by his earlier behavior, because he was so worried that he would be seen as a traitor because he'd stuck his neck out so far. And, you know, all along he had been arguing for Hong Kong. He had been a voice for Hong Kong. So I really saw these unofficials as Hong Kong's first politicians in many ways, because what they were doing was they were standing up for an ideal and they were acting as the voice of Hong Kongers when Hong Kongers sort of had no place, had no voice. So I saw them as these extraordinary figures who in so many ways have just been forgotten about, even in Hong Kong.
Earlier, you made a statement about, you know, Carrie Lam deciding to step down as chief executive. What does that future hold for Hong Kong? You know, the fact that the candidate that is likely to be the next chief executive put down the protests in a pretty brutal way. And what is the state of the protest movement at this point?
I mean, I think it's very much the fact that the former Secretary for Security is the only candidate to be chief executive is very much a sign of what is to come. You know, since the national security legislation has been imposed, there's really been a singular focus on national security, and that's permeated every aspect of life. You know, even school curricula are being rewritten. So subjects like chemistry and history and geography are being taught with a national security focus. And that will not change under the, you know, if John Lee, the only candidate, becomes chief executive, that will definitely not change. He is seen as kind of loyal, and in a way that even the current chief executive, you know, even more so than the current chief executive. So, you know, the future of the protest movement inside Hong Kong, I think, is very dim. You know, since the legislation has been passed, there've been more than 180 people have been charged under the national security legislation, you know, for sedition, secession, subversion, or collusion with foreign powers. And so I think that has really, because the legislation is so broad and so vague, that's really muzzled the movement, because it's so hard to know where the lines are. You know, as people say in Hong Kong, there are no red lines anymore. There's just a red sea. What we are seeing is this huge outflow of people, and a lot of activity in Hong Kong communities overseas. You know, even here in Australia, there was a film which is called Revolution of Our Times, which is now a banned phrase in Hong Kong. And the film itself is banned in Hong Kong. And they just showed it here at the beginning of April. And when they put the tickets up for sale, the demand was so high that the website went down. They sold thousands of tickets in, you know, just minutes. And, you know, I think those Hong Kongers that have left are taking with them their aspirations. So, you know, as one Hong Konger in exile told me, you know, the movement is still there. The battlefield, though, is now global.
The name of the book is Indelible City. Louisa Lim, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rich.
Louisa Lim is a former correspondent for the BBC and NPR. She's currently a senior lecturer at the University of Melbourne and hosts the Little Red Podcast on China. Her new book is titled Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. It's published by Riverhead. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.